This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Okay, here's a cancer joke that's been circulating. What do you call a young adult cancer patient with health insurance? A Canadian. People in their 20s and 30s are the largest group of underinsured adults in America. I have two guests who fell into that category when they got their diagnosis, and they've each written about what it's like to be in your 20s dealing with issues like, how does cancer change your sex life? We invited them to tell us about their adventures with health insurance and cancer. Carol Rosenthal is the author of Everything Changes, The Insider's Guide to Cancer in Your 20s and 30s. Eva Skoch is a journalist who frequently writes about travel. She recently wrote an article for Newsweek's online edition about cancertainment, the proliferation of websites and blogs by people in their 20s and 30s that combine confessions, information, and humor. Skoch divides her time between New York and Prague, where she grew up, and she has some interesting comparisons between health insurance there and here. Eva Skoch, Carol Rosenthal, welcome to Fresh Air. Can we start with a kind of cancer roll call? I'd like to ask you each when you were diagnosed, what you were diagnosed with, and what your status is now. Eva, can we start with you?
Sure. So I was a perfectly healthy 29-year-old in 2006, and I started having weird symptoms. I was getting hungry in the middle of the night, and I had this desire to eat ice cubes all the time, and just very odd. I can't say that I was in pain, but it was enough to make me go to the doctor, and they found that I had colon cancer.
And where are you now?
It's been 2.5 years since I finished chemo, which my prognosis is very good, aside from the fact that they did find that I have a mutated gene, which I inherited from my mom. And that just means that the cancer will probably keep coming back. But from what I can tell, it's not very lethal. So because they have chemotherapy that can treat it. So there's good news and there's bad news.
Carol, what about you? Tell us about the cancer you had and what your prognosis is now.
Well, I was diagnosed with cancer when I was 27, and I was also an otherwise healthy vegan 27-year-old dancer. And a lump was noticed on my neck by a chiropractor. I'd never been to a chiropractor in my life, but injured my neck during a dance rehearsal. And it actually took quite a while for me to get diagnosed, which is very common for young adults because we often either don't have enough health insurance to get to the doctor or the doctors just don't believe that we could possibly have cancer. But I did have thyroid cancer, and it had spread to 30 lymph nodes in my neck. And that was 9 years ago this week, actually. And I'm still living with thyroid cancer. I've never been in remission. Thyroid cancer is typically very treatable and has a very high success rate. And I'm very lucky that this probably is not going to be what kills me. But there is, at the moment, no cure for me. So I am living with two tumors that are wedged up against my jugular vein. And I'm on a wait and watch program.
Now, you were both diagnosed when you were in your 20s. And people in their 20s statistically are in a very uninsured or non-insured demographic. Did you each have health insurance when you were diagnosed?
Well, I did, but my situation is a little bit different because I was insured. I went to the doctor, and my diagnosis was covered. But I'm originally from Prague, which is in the Czech Republic, socialized medicine. And I decided to go and get treatment there simply because I honestly was not able to deal with all the billing issues that I had to deal with. I mean, just from the first week after being diagnosed, I had a stack of bills about 2 inches. And it seemed like I constantly dealt with people from insurance companies trying to figure out what I have to pay, what I don't have to pay. Meanwhile, I was going through this life-changing experience, and it seemed like all I could focus on was these billing issues. So that was ultimately what made me decide to go back to the Czech Republic and get treatment there. And, of course, part of my family is there, too.
Did you say they have socialized medicine there?
Yes.
For critics of the Obama healthcare proposals. Socialized medicine is a word they put out there to scare people, to terrify people about what this plan might mean for Americans. You're saying that you went to the Czech Republic, where you're from, because they have socialized medicine. What was it like getting treated there as opposed to your experience in the United States?
Well, I really cannot say anything bad about the care there. I got great care. It is different than being treated in the U.S., and I think the biggest difference is that doctors are generally much more pleasant and nicer here. Back in the Czech Republic, it's a very, German-style, efficient kind of care. So they don't really spend a lot of time talking to patients about making them feel good. It's really all business. So I think that was probably the biggest difference, bedside manners. And, you know, people always tell me, you know, don't you have to wait when you go to a country where there's socialized medicine? Don't you have to book an appointment 2 months in advance? And I really did not have that problem, just because I think everybody felt that I was young and they needed to push me ahead of people who were just going for checkups. So I really did not have to wait any more than I wait when I go to see my doctor in the U.S. But, you know, of course, there is, once I got into the remission part of my disease, you know, then I noticed that I have to start waiting around quite a bit. Like, I had to wait for a PET scan for several months because one of the machines was broken. And they're like, well, you know, there's no indication that shows that there's anything wrong with you. Your blood markers are okay, so why don't you just wait with the PET scan? I think that would probably be something that people in the U.S. might have a hard time getting used to.
And do you think that was because the Czech Republic doesn't have as much money as the United States, or because it's socialized medicine?
I think it's probably, you know, there are not as many of these PET scans in the country. There's just not, I mean, there's a lot more equipment in the U.S. So I think that's part of it. But at the same time, you know, when I got treatment there, part of my treatment was taking Avastin, which is a very new drug, and it's actually not chemo. It's a bio-based drug that basically starves your tumors from blood supply. And that's considered a very experimental drug in the U.S. that a lot of insurance companies don't want to cover. And, you know, because it costs tens of thousands of dollars. And that's what they gave me there. And it was never an issue of cost.
And just one more thing about this. You said in the United States you were going through this life-changing experience, having just been diagnosed with cancer, and all you had time to do was call insurance companies and read their bills. When you went to the Czech Republic, where you're from, and you got treated there with their socialized medicine, did you have bills? Did you have paperwork to deal with, or, you know, phone calls that you had to make to clarify billing?
No, I never got a single bill for anything. It all happens in the background. The only thing I had to pay for was that I wanted a better room in the hospital, which means you get your own private room with a private bathroom and TV and fridge and all that, which is not the standard. So I had to pay for that as if I were staying in a hotel.
Is it a lot of money?
Oh, it was very cheap. It was about $35 a day.
Okay. Kara, let's talk about your experience with health insurance. Were you insured when you got your cancer diagnosis?
Before I dive into that, can I comment on a couple of things
that Eva had said?
Uh-huh. So certainly we do have a lot of access to great technology here in the United States. And we hear about all kinds of technology that's coming out and so beneficial for cancer patients, but it's really also not available everywhere here. I have been seeing a doctor in New York City, even though I live here in Chicago, and he had wanted me to get tests and follow up here in Chicago that he could then read the results of in New York. And I go to a very good hospital in both cities. And so here at Northwestern Memorial Hospital, they don't actually have the kind of PET scan that's most advanced and would be the most beneficial for my doctor to read. It combines PET scan technology and CAT scan technology in the same machine, and there's actually not one of these machines in the entire city of Chicago. So there's great technology available, but it really isn't available everywhere. And in Chicago, the place where I would go to receive this is a National Cancer Institute Comprehensive Cancer Care Center, and they don't have the money to afford one of these machines.
Well, Karen, let me ask you, if you had health insurance when you were diagnosed, you're in your 20s, and demographically, people in their 20s tend to be uninsured or underinsured.
I thought I had health insurance when I was diagnosed. I actually had health insurance the day that I was diagnosed, but when I called to get a second opinion from another doctor, the nurse on the other end of the line said, "I'm sorry, we can't schedule you for a second opinion because you don't have any health insurance." And to me, hearing that I had no health insurance was way more startling than even hearing that I had cancer in the first place.
How did you not have health insurance when you thought you had health insurance?
Well, it's because my employer had forgotten to submit my COBRA paperwork. Ugh. So I was leaving a job, and I had filled out all of the paperwork, and I submitted what I needed to submit, but they didn't submit what they needed to submit.
We'll just say very briefly what COBRA is, because a lot of people don't know COBRA.
Sure. COBRA is a form of health insurance that's a continuation of your employer-based health insurance. So if you're leaving a job and you are on employer-based health insurance, COBRA enables you to continue to stay on that same health insurance for a designated period of time, but you have to pay out of pocket for it. But at least it allows you to remain on group health insurance and to gain coverage. And my problem was, because I had been diagnosed with cancer just a week before, I now had this mar on my record. I had a pre-existing condition, so I was not able to go out and obtain my own health insurance. I could only get on to group health insurance through an employer, which COBRA counts as.
So what did you end up having in terms of insurance?
Well, first I had a lot of conversations with my former employer to figure out if there was any way to remedy their mistake. I was working for a very small art museum, and dealing with issues of health insurance is something that they had never done before. And it's also interesting to me that this isn't brought up so much in the current healthcare debate, that small businesses are not people who are running small businesses are not necessarily people who are well trained in human resources and insurance. So it was up to me to spend my time on the phone with the COBRA administration and with the privatized company that was administering the COBRA. And that's what I did for the first month after my diagnosis. I was on the phone Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, haggling with people.
So finally you did have insurance?
I did manage to get insurance. I ended up finding ways that I could have conversations with various people at the COBRA administration and sort of blame them on losing paperwork of mine that never actually existed. And I ended up sort of weaseling my way into getting back onto COBRA.
What was it like for you emotionally during those first few weeks when you were dealing with this cancer diagnosis, but spending all your time on the phone haggling with insurance companies?
You know, the image that kept coming to mind over and over again is you hear these legends or myths about children who are trapped underneath a car and their moms are just suddenly empowered with this like Herculean strength and they're able to pick up this massive hunk of metal and get their child out from this trapped situation. And I kept thinking, I feel like the child and the mother at the same time, and I'm just trapped underneath this incredibly complex and suffocating system of healthcare, and I'm trying to save myself, and I have to use my own energy to do it. And so, you know, I felt like I was constantly on, 9 to 5, on the phone. I had to present a good case. I used the fact that I was a young adult to my advantage. If I could make people feel sorry for me or even get them to shed a tear over the fact that I was young and living with cancer, I knew I sort of had them in the palm of my hand. But it was really exhausting. So when these phones shut down and at nighttime, I was a wreck. I mean, I was hysterical. I was crying all of the time. And I was just really exhausted. I think a lot of people think that when you're diagnosed with cancer, it's about healing, taking a bath, lighting candles.
Really, really, really.
Writing in your journal. Maybe you can do some meditation or go to the juice bar and drink your wheatgrass juice. But I wasn't. I was utterly exhausted, frustrated, and completely freaked out that I might die because I don't have access to health insurance.
Well, I'm so glad that you got it. Do you each have health insurance now? And are you on good plans? Are you getting what you need without having to spend all your time haggling on the telephone?
Well, my situation is still pretty nice because I still have a choice between U.S. health insurance and Czech health insurance. So I always have a backup plan to fall on. But now I have half my doctors over there, half my doctors over here, and my insurance here is very good now, but I still get tons of bills and I never know what to do with them. And it's still a stress factor. And anytime I can choose between going to the doctor here and flying back to the Czech Republic, I do that because even with the cost of an air ticket, it usually ends up being cheaper there.
Even with your health insurance, it's cheaper to go to the Czech Republic?
Yes, because the doctor who diagnosed me and who I trust very much is not on my plan. So I always have to pay pretty high copays, which is great, but it's hard when you're put in the situation of choosing a doctor online. You know, that's something I did not grow up in the U.S., so I was never used to the system. And to me, choosing a doctor online that, you know, doctor on my plan is just crazy. I don't know how people do that. So, I mean, I went with a doctor who was recommended to me. And of course, it's not a doctor on my plan. So I end up having to pay copays and I don't really know how to get out of that cycle.
Carol, what about you? How's your health insurance situation now?
My health insurance has radically changed because I got married to a man who happens to have white glove health insurance. It's night and day.
Way to go.
Yeah.
Good choice.
You know, it really stinks being single with cancer. And at one point in time, I actually considered trying to find a health insurance card marriage, you know, trying to find someone who would be nice to me and I could get married to and get onto their health insurance. But luckily, I ended up finding a man who I absolutely love and adore to marry who also happens to have great health insurance. And I'm so grateful to my husband's employer. And it's something that I'm plagued with anxiety about, especially with the current situation in the economy, is that I know that we have great insurance now, but I also know that, you know, we're just one pink slip away from me not being able to have cancer care. And it's very scary.
So what about pre-existing conditions? How does that figure into insurance when you're getting on your husband's insurance?
Well, it's group insurance, so they're not allowed to discriminate because of pre-existing conditions. Now, even though they can't discriminate, there are certainly situations in which pressure can be put upon you. For example, I was working a job. It was the first job I had after radiation treatment, and it was not a job I preferred to be working, but I was working it because I knew that I could get onto that employer's group health care plan, even though I had pre-existing conditions. But I started getting phone calls from my employer's insurance agent, and they sort of went like this. Carol, I'm calling from this, you know, XYZ insurance company, and I'm gathering some information, and I was wondering if you could tell me when you're going to be done with cancer. Do you know when your cancer is going to be over? And it's like I would get these phone calls regularly from him because what he was trying to do was calculate how much I was costing the company that I was working for because I made their rates go up.
Let's talk about some of the unique issues facing people with cancer in their 20s or 30s. Eva, you say that people of that age often fall into a no man's land between pediatric oncology and adult oncology with very few traditional outlets able to cater to their needs. How are the needs of people in their 20s and 30s different from most other cancer patients?
First of all, I think it has to do with the fact that when you're in your 20s or 30s, you stick out. When you come for radiation or chemotherapy, you're surrounded by patients in their 50s and 60s, and nobody really knows how to talk to you. So that automatically puts you in a very odd spot, that people pity you. Or I've had people ask me repeatedly about what I eat. Because, you know, when people hear colon cancer, they think, oh, that's the cancer you get from bad eating. Now I'm 29, I'm thin, I'm an athlete. And it made me feel like people are always trying to blame me. And, you know, the fact is that there's so much we don't know about cancer, and there's so many types of cancer. So that was hard for me. But then also some of the more practical issues are, for example, fertility. I had my own experience with, you know, fertility treatment, trying to get my eggs, or I should say embryos, frozen before chemo in case my husband and I ever decide to have kids. You know, chemo could make you infertile. So I was going through that, and I did not feel like there was a lot of guidance. So much about cancer is doctors trying to save your life, which is great. And of course, they should. At the same time, there are so many other issues that could improve your quality of life if you do happen to survive, such as being able to have children.
Let me stop you for a second. So at the same time, you don't know if you're going to survive the chemo. You're also thinking about preserving your eggs in case you want to have children.
Right.
That's
exactly.
A emotionally really extreme thing to put yourself through.
And that's it was very hard. And of course, you know, the hormone treatment is not the easiest thing to go through when you are. I happened to do mine when I was after surgery, and they told me that they have about 2 weeks. So if I could manage to get my eggs frozen in 2 weeks, then I can go ahead and do that. But after 2 weeks, they wanted to start chemo. And the same day, I had my oncology appointment, and the same day, you know, my husband was donating sperm. And a couple of weeks later, we had 14 embryos on ice, and we were looking at each other like, how did we even get here?
Have you used any of those embryos?
No, not yet. They're still frozen in a, you know, freezer in Prague. And sometimes I look back and I think about it, and I'm like, you know, I'm probably a bad mother already. I have these children. I have these children in a random freezer in Prague. I never go see them. And, you know, those are difficult choices to make. I think if I had more time to think about it, I honestly still don't know what I would have done. But
do you know for sure if you're infertile?
I don't know for sure. They say that the way to find out is if you get your period back, then there's a good chance that you are still fertile, and which I did. But of course, then they say that it could also cause major damage to your ovaries and uterus. So so there's all that. And my type of cancer, I have the additional problem that my type of cancer actually affects the uterus. So they are recommending that I get my uterus removed within the next couple of years just to prevent cancer from spreading there.
Wow. So if that happened, you couldn't implant any of the eggs in your own body.
Right. Right.
You know, I should say in your recent Newsweek article about young people in their 20s and 30s diagnosed with cancer, you're right. Young people don't feel like they need to whisper after they lose a breast, a testicle, or sex drive. So in the spirit of that, let me ask you this. With colon cancer, a lot of people get colostomies, which is a really awful predicament to be in when you're young. I mean, no one wants a colostomy bag, but particularly when you're young and still sexually active, I think it's probably worse. So did you have to make a big decision about whether to go for that or not?
Yeah, I actually did. That was one of the hardest decisions I had to make, because the first surgeon I ever met with here in New York suggested that he removes my entire colon, basically, because I had three different tumors in three different places, and trying to cut around it would be difficult and also would increase my chances of you know, some cancer cells still remaining in my body. But of course, that would mean getting a bag, at least temporarily. I guess he was telling me that if you only leave a little part of the colon, that your body actually adjusts after a while and you don't actually have to keep the bag. But of course, still, you know, I was 29, I was a travel writer, and I remember standing in his office thinking about what I was going to do at the airport when they asked me if I was carrying any liquids.
That's such a ridiculous thing to have to think about.
I know. It was my life, and I, you know, loved my job, and you know, that was such a big part of my day-to-day routine. So I said, you know, I just cannot do that to myself. So I chose to take the riskier route and have only, I believe it was about a half of my colon removed, and then hoping for the best that it won't return, or even if I do have to get the rest of my colon removed in the future, at least, you know, I've had a few years when I did not have to tell TSA I was carrying I was carrying liquids on me.
When you feel like your body is failing you, when your body is a cause of great anxiety, is it difficult to feel real sexual?
Actually, my experience is quite the opposite, because having colon cancer, you pretty much have to decide whether you're going to be open about it or not, because colon cancer is kind of an embarrassing cancer to have. Mm-hmm. You always have to talk about your stool and, you know, all kinds of scopes, and, you know, a lot of people avoid talking about it for that reason, because talking about it can lead you to paths that you're not ready to discuss with strangers. I chose to be very open about talking about colon cancer. One of the reasons is that Czech Republic actually has the highest colon cancer rates in the world. And I think it's partially due to the fact that people don't talk about it. It's kind of a taboo. So I have chosen to be very open about it. And every time somebody asks me, I tell them everything. Which, you know, being so open about talking about your body actually opened me up to be a lot more open about sex as well. Because you, by being open, I think you start understanding your body a lot better. What goes on, you know, what doesn't feel right. So for me, it did not make me feel less sexual. If anything, it was really just the physiological changes that happen with chemo. That, you know, you just feel tired and you are kind of in pain. But that kind of went away right after finishing treatment.
Carol, you were single when you were diagnosed with thyroid cancer. How did that affect your feelings about sexuality, especially with men you were just meeting?
I actually think it made me feel more comfortable about my sexuality, because that's one thing that at the time when I was first diagnosed was not impacted by my cancer. And I felt like it's something that my body was still capable of and could do well. And so I felt like having sex was one thing that I could still use my body for without feeling as though my body was failing me. It was also just a really great way to escape the stress and anxiety that I was experiencing and dealing with all of the insurance company madness. It was a way for me to help forget about having spent the entire day sitting in a waiting room, going for blood work. So for me, it was just kind of this amazing escapist activity to engage in. It has changed over the course of my treatment. I'm on hormone therapy and have been for 9 years. And one of the side effects of that is that I'm kept in this extremely hyperthyroid state. A lot of people who are hyperthyroid go to the endocrinologist to kind of get their hormones balanced out to be at this state of equilibrium. But being hyperthyroid is actually one of the only ways that they can try to curb the growth of my cancer cells. And one of the side effects of that is anxiety, which manifests for me as extreme claustrophobia. So as my numbers elevated, I started becoming more and more anxious, and to the point where I eventually had to take medication for anti-anxiety to outweigh the side effect that was coming from my hormone therapy. And being on anti-anxiety medications can definitely have an impact on your sex drive. So I went from feeling like I was kind of this randy 15-year-old boy to, you know, over time feeling slightly less interested in being sexual and having spent more time in the hospital and feeling like, you know, my body belonged to doctors and just being touched and poked and prodded and exposed and sort of at the mercy of someone else. I went from, you know, feeling very comfortable being extremely sexual early on in my cancer experience to being much more tame and reserved about my body now.
Eva, you recently wrote an article for Newsweek Online that was titled "A Malignant Melanoma Walks into a Bar." And it was about how some patients in their 20s and 30s are using humor to fight back against cancer. And a few people have coined the term cancertainment to describe this kind of new breed of website and book. So tell us a little bit about what you found in the field of cancertainment.
I guess that's our generation. That's what we do when something like this, like cancer, or something very traumatic happens to us. We go online and we Google it, or you know, we try to find information. And that's what I did when it first happened to me. And I was shocked to find that, you know, while you're there looking for hope, a lot of the times you actually find just very, very brutal statistics. So I started looking for different things in the world of cancer. Once I typed into Google cancer and hilarious and see what would come up, and I actually found a blog by a 23-year-old San Francisco fashion designer who has a blog titled "Cancer is Hilarious," and she documents her everyday experiences with cancer on her blog for other people to read. And I just thought that was such a sweet idea to do that, because when I was first diagnosed and I was first going through treatment, I felt like I absolutely did not have the perspective to write about my experience and to be funny about it. When I tried to write about it, it always ended up sounding like a cliche. You know, it was always something about live every day like it's your last or something. And I read it and I just thought, wow, this is just so not real. So I actually never published anything in the first year that I had cancer. And then I started looking at these blogs and I just had so much respect for people who are able and willing to do that, because I did find that those blogs were very helpful to me. Just gave me a little bit of hope. And, you know, there are people out there who are in a very critical state and they're dying and they know they're dying and they're still documenting their experiences. And I was just so touched by the openness and kind of the sense of humor and irony that I decided to write about it.
And Carol, you kind of contribute to Cancertainment through your website radio show. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, I'm a host of something called The Stupid Cancer Show. And I also have a blog where I write almost daily about my cancer and the cancer experience. And what I found when I was talking to other survivors traveling around the United States and interviewing young adults, and I'd meet with them one-on-one, often in their living rooms, and we'd have these really lengthy interviews. The shortest one was 3 hours, the longest one was 12 hours. And people were really excited to have somebody from the outside world come into their life and talk to them about this experience that was so personal. And they started spilling details of their life to me that they had never shared with anyone else before. They hadn't told their doctors, their spouses, their partners, their parents. And so one thing that I heard over and over again is that people really were craving the opportunity to allow themselves to feel vulnerable, and that there's a lot of hype in the cancer world about hope. And we do all need hope to get through. But sometimes it's to the detriment of being able to express feelings of vulnerability or feeling weak. And so it was exciting for me to be able to have these conversations where people could show another side of cancer other than just, you know, breaking the tape at the finish of a walkathon or climbing a mountain. They were talking about how they could climb into bed at night with their scary thoughts and their scary feelings. And while that might not sound like, you know, prime entertainment to most, I've gotten a really great response to these stories from other cancer patients who are really wanting to hear the raw and candid experiences of what other young adults are going through.
Since healthcare, health insurance is so important to each of you, how closely are you following the debate and what kind of action, if any, are you taking?
I was following and do follow the debate extremely closely. I had to take a little bit of a break for it for about a week because I was so disgusted by what I was seeing on television, the coverage of the town hall meetings, but I've recovered from that now and I'm back in action and I'm extremely vocal. I've gone to the Capitol. I've met with Senator Kennedy's staff and had lengthy meetings talking to them about the needs of young adults. And I think it's extremely important that young adults be vocal beyond their blogs and that we call our representatives and ask for in-person meetings with their staffers around these issues.
And Eva?
I actually cannot vote in the U.S., so it's a little bit hard for me to take a stand that's that would actually change something. But I've been following the debates very closely, and sometimes I'm appalled by some of the arguments about socialized healthcare, and I'm appalled by people telling me that I really should stay in the U.S. because the U.S. has the best healthcare system in the world, and that I'm kind of taking chances going back to the Czech Republic to get care, which I think is just so inappropriate. You know, you can say whatever you want about socialized healthcare versus privatized healthcare, but the truth is that any healthcare coverage is better than no coverage at all. And I think that's what young adult cancer patients are dealing with, and that's just something that's unacceptable in a society as advanced as the U.S.
Well, listen, I want to thank you both very much for being so open with us about your experiences. And I also want to wish you the best in the future with your health. Thank you again.
Thanks so much
for having us.
Carol Rosenthal is the author of Everything Changes, The Insider's Guide to Cancer in Your 20s and 30s. Eva Skoch is a travel writer who wrote about young adults with cancer for Newsweek Online. They were both diagnosed with cancer when they were in their 20s. It's been 10 years since Lori Moore published a new book. Her last was the best-selling short story collection, Birds of America. For Moore's many restless fans, including book critic Maureen Corrigan, the long wait for a new book is finally over. Maureen has a review of Lori Moore's new novel, A Gate at the Stairs.
Lori Moore's style is one of a kind. Her day job is teaching writing at the University of Wisconsin, but the irony there is that unlike, say, Hemingway or Dostoevsky, the style of Moore's own short stories and novels could never be taught through worshipful imitation. It's swirling and wry and messy and sucks you in like a literary cyclone so that you feel like you're at the center of some great life force, even if you can't always understand the meaning of all the things whipping around you. And that feeling of simultaneous wonder and bemusement is intensified to the max in Moore's latest natural phenomenon of a novel called A Gate at the Stairs. As in her last novel, Who Will Run the Frog Hospital, which came out in 1994, Moore uses the convention here of an adult narrator looking back on her younger self. In the present time of the novel, the fall of 2001, Tassie Kelchin is a 20-year-old college student in the Midwest. Untethered from her childhood on the family farm, Tassie is eager to be seduced by ideas. She encapsulates the excitement of college thusly. Twice a week, a young professor named Thad, dressed in jeans and a tie, stood before a lecture hall of stunned farm kids like me and spoke thrillingly of Henry James's masturbation of the comma. I was riveted. I had never before seen a man wearing jeans with a tie. Tassie is also ready to be emotionally seduced by people, and she finds herself swept up into the lives of a sophisticated couple named Edward, a research scientist, and Sarah, owner of an upscale restaurant. When Tassie first meets Sarah, she describes her as one of those women who, instead of laughing, said, "That's funny," or instead of smiling, said, "That's interesting." The couple hires her to be a part-time nanny for the child they hope to adopt, and because they're white and their toddler daughter, when she arrives from foster care, is part black, political questions about race and adoption come to the fore. Back on the farm, Tassie's younger goof-off brother Robert is graduating high school, and he decides to join the military and head over to Afghanistan as a way of sidestepping his alternative fate, the local diesel driving school. By novel's end, everything that seems solid in Tassie's life sorrowfully melts into air. If you're one of those paranoid readers who believes that every detail means something, and in a Laurie Moore story you can never be too paranoid, you might catch on to the fact before I did that A Gate at the Stairs surrealistically layers the essential Jane Eyre elements of a hyper-observant nanny, a governess, if you will, a key character of mixed race, a dread secret, and a remote cad of an employer named Edward. It's alone worth reading this novel just to see how Moore, on her last page, raucously upends the famous closing lines of Jane Eyre, "Reader, I married him." But the overarching reason to read more is to surrender yourself to how perceptively she reads the world. Sometimes her language makes you laugh because you're taken by surprise by how on target it is, like when Tassie describes her middle-aged mother's thickening face as being framed in a cameo of meat. Other times, Moore's ability to nail the ineffable is chilling. When Edward enters the story for the first time, late for an adoption meeting with the birth mother, no less, Tassie describes how he looks around the room and then turned to his own paper cup of coffee, which he sipped from, as if it were not just delicious, but urgent. And I could see he was showing us himself, his aquiline profile, so that for a minute he did not have to trouble himself to admire us, but to soak up our appreciation of him. I could see it was his habit to imperceptibly dominate and insult. Maybe that's too much for any college kid, or even for the older Tassie, to read into a pose, but who cares? Moore's penetrating and singular voice as a writer is one I could listen to for years and years.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed A Gate at the Stairs by Laurie Moore. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.